Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Yvonne Smith, and this is Late Night with a Hero. And tonight we have visiting us Oryx Cohen, who is currently the director of National Empowerment Center's Technical Assistance Center. Oryx, are you there?
I am here.
Okay. Well, just to tell you a little bit about Oryx, Oryx is a leader in the International Consumer Survivor Ex-Patient Movement. And as I said, he is currently the director of the National Empowerment Center's Technical Assistance Center, which was previously headed by Daniel Fisher. Oryx is featured in Agnes Jacket, a book by Gail Hornstein, where Oryx and a fellow Freedom Center co-founder Will Hall are compared to the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. Oryx is a board member of the Hearing Voices Network USA, an emotional CPR trainer. Oryx co-produced and stars in a film called Healing Voices, and that film actually is going to be released April 29th of 2016. Oryx, can you tell us about how you got involved in the consumer survivor movement?
Sure, yeah. It was 1999 that I had my first experience and encounter with the mental health system. I had just moved from Oregon out to Massachusetts to go to grad school, and I ended up going through an altered state and being hospitalized, and so that's how I got introduced to this all was I had a hospital stint at UMass in Worcester, Massachusetts, and UMass Medical, and I was just really blown away by how I was treated in the hospital, and it really was devastating when I received a diagnosis, because I felt like I was kind of thrown out of the human race, and I was prescribed a lot of drugs, which I didn't want to take, but it was obvious that I would have to take them to be able to leave the hospital. And so right away I was seeing that the way people were treated was not so good, I really bonded with some of the patients on that first day I had in the hospital, and I decided in that hospital stay that I wanted to try to do something to make a difference for people who went through some difficult times and, you know, altered states or extreme states or psychosis, whatever you want to call it. And I wanted to create something different for people so they would have a better experience than me, than what I had in the hospital. So that's what motivated me to get involved with the movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think people actually benefit by being in the hospital for long periods of time?
Well, in the way that hospitals currently operate, I don't think so. Based on the standard of care, which is basically a high level of drugging. And what I've seen is that it tends to lead to a lot of dependence on the system. And so I can speak for myself. The hospital has not been a helpful place for me, that anything that the hospital has done could have been done in a different setting. And I know that there are people that say they've had a decent experience in a hospital, but that hasn't been my experience.
Mm-hmm. And then after that, what happened to you after that? I mean, after that experience?
Well, I was really inspired to, like I said, try to make a difference. And so I went back to grad school, and I was in grad school for public policy and administration, and they let me study mental health policy. And I started doing a bunch of research on the mental health system, and that's when I started to find the movement. And so some of the first places I found were the National Empowerment Center. I remember calling the National Empowerment Center when I was fresh out of the hospital, and Lori Ahern answered the phone and had a really good conversation with her, told her that I didn't think I was mentally ill, that I thought there was other ways to heal. And she basically just affirmed me and supported me and said, hey, I don't think you're mentally ill either. So that was really the first time that I had been validated in a while. So that meant a lot. And I remember I ordered, like, there was some videos and things, I think a Pat Deegan video that I ordered from NEC that helped. And I also got in touch with what was then called Support Coalition International. It's now Mind Freedom. And I remember talking to David Oakes, and that was amazing because I called Support Coalition, and David Oakes answers the phone, and it's not too often that the executive director answers the phone himself. So I got in a conversation with him, and he was also very supportive. And I ended up volunteering for them as an internship for graduate school, and got to go out to Oregon, which is actually, it turns out, I was in school in Massachusetts. I had just moved from Oregon, and Mind Freedom was in Eugene, Oregon. So in my hometown, which was quite a coincidence.
Eugene is your hometown?
Yeah, Eugene, Oregon, where I grew up. Yeah. And little did I know that that's where Mind Freedom is. So I was able to connect with them and do an oral history project with them where I interviewed lots of people who had been through similar experiences. And that was amazing.
That was in the 80s.
No, that was 2000. Yeah.
Oh, relatively recent.
Yeah, yeah, I've been involved for about 16 years now. 16 years. Yeah.
So you got involved with great heroes like David Oakes, and you were living in Eugene at the time?
Well, I was still in graduate school out in Massachusetts, so I was living in Amherst, Massachusetts, and I spent the summer in Eugene, but that's where I grew up, so it was nice to be around family for a bit and whatnot.
What was your study in your master's program?
It was public administration, so kind of learning how to work with nonprofits and public policy. But they let me focus on mental health policy. They were actually very accommodating in the program, in the master's program there, because they had known that I was in the hospital for a while. But they were extremely accommodating and let me focus on what I wanted to focus on. And I really, I had a great experience at that school. And in fact, the second year I was there is when I met my future wife. So that was cool too. And actually, she was with me during the second time that I went through an altered state, which was at the end after I graduated from the program. I went through another experience that landed me in a hospital. But she was with me the whole time, and my experience was actually better because I had her as an advocate, and she actually printed out my story, which kind of read that I was a pretty, you know, kick butt advocate, and so they treated me well, or, you know, at least better than the first time hospital. So.
And what do you think? What do you think was the reason for that? Because it was a different place, or because she had an advocate, or?
I think the place was a little bit better, maybe. But yeah, I think the major reason is because I had an advocate, and she was very clear that I wasn't high on psychiatric drugs. And even though she said that I prefer not to take psych drugs, they still tried to prescribe me stuff, and I still felt like I had to take something or they wouldn't let me out. Just the state of our hospitals, like you can't really go in there and not get out without taking anything. At least I haven't heard of many people who are successful doing that. So I ended up being prescribed more psych drugs. But
mm-hmm.
Every time I've been prescribed something, I've been able to wean off safely, because really it doesn't work for me. It actually harms me quite a bit. It may help temporarily to help me get me out of an altered state, but anything beyond that is really damaging. Doesn't work for me.
So when did I understand you're the co-founder of the Freedom Center? So when did that come about?
That was 2001. David Oakes basically emailed Will Hall and myself, and we're both kind of just starting to work in the movement. And he said, "You two should meet. You're in the same area." And so we did. Will and I, we met at a coffee shop in Northampton, Massachusetts, and we really connected. We had very similar experience, had similar feelings, psychiatry, and so we decided to start a group together. And we got a very small grant from the Department of Mental Health, actually. We got like $500, literally a $500 grant to start a group. We called it the Psychiatry Alternative Support Group originally.
mm-hmm.
And
you mean
started
$5,000 or $500?
$500.
Oh, mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, very small amount. Basically paid the rent for our church for a space to meet, and that's about it. But we started meeting, and slowly but surely like-minded people came together, you know, all ex-patients. And through the course of a few years, we're able to get some more grants, non-government grants, and we were able to build an amazing organization that was all volunteers. And we, you know, at our prime, we were doing a support group every week. We were doing yoga, acupuncture every week. We had a radio show, which is now turned into to Madness Radio. We, you know, had a great website. We do all kinds of training and events in the community, and we even got to be known, you know, nationally and internationally. And we never had any paid staff or anything like that. I think the biggest our budget ever got was like $20,000 a year. So it was a very small budget, but
so this was before. This was before peer specialists came to be.
Exactly. Yeah. This was right as peer specialists were starting out, but before it exploded. This was before that. We didn't know a whole lot about what else was going on, except for maybe Mind Freedom, and there was a few other places that we knew of. And so we were very afraid that we were going to get in trouble by the psychiatric police, and we would hiding out in basements and talking about all these radical ideas, and and slowly we got more confident, and we got more people involved, and got even more vocal.
When did you get involved with the Hearing Voices Network? Because, and I've been doing some research on that. I thought that had started in the United Kingdom.
Yeah. So that is related to the Freedom Center. We had a professor named Gail Hornstein, who is a professor at Mount Holyoke College, who started coming to the Freedom Center group because they're open to anybody really who wants to talk and is not there to observe. And so we got to be friends with her, and it turns out that she was doing a lot of research, and she was visiting over in the UK to learn more about the Hearing Voices Network. And so she would talk about what they were doing with the Hearing Voices Network over there and how cool it was and whatnot. And at that point, there was only a few groups in the U.S., and we didn't even know about them at that point. But there was just a few, and they weren't very well known. And,
in case people don't know, can you tell us about the Hearing Voice Network? Who comes there and who might find it helpful?
It was started by a person who hears voices named Patsy Haga, who questioned her psychiatrist, Rome, and this was in Holland in like 1985. And because the psychiatrist, like most psychiatrists, was not believing her when she said she heard voices and was trying to make her stop thinking that she heard voices. And eventually this woman was able to convince this doctor, Marius Rome, that she was having a real experience. And so they ended up going on a very mainstream TV show in Holland and talking about working together, because once Marius Rome actually started being curious about Patsy's experience of hearing voices, Patsy started to get better. And when she started talking about the voices, and she started talking to other people who heard voices, support each other. So that was really the birth of the Hearing Voices Network. A bunch of groups started then in the UK, and that has continued to today. In England, there's over 100 in England alone. So the Hearing Voices Network is comprised of 25 countries now around the world, and there are several groups all around the world, support groups. There's a World Congress every year where people gather from all over the world to have a conference. There's all kinds of research and literature that's based out of the Hearing Voices Network, and all on the theme that hearing voices and other altered states are normal human experiences. And there are, you know, and it's powerful to get together and talk about those experiences. So it really kind of normalized.
Other than what you've already said, because I have, you know, I'm heavily on Facebook and a little bit of Twitter. And I just had one of my Facebook friends who hears voices in Australia. They're, in fact, in the hospital, and I talked to them by video chat, and I'm going to share the show with them. Okay. Other than what you've already said, how is the Hearing Voices different than another support group that we have? Like, how is it different than AA, NA, or like DBSA or Emotions Anonymous? How is that different since you're a pioneer bringing that to the U.S.?
That's a good question. It's really a group that is focused on talking about either hearing voices or other altered experiences like seeing visions, having feeling experiences with touch, things touching you, or unusual beliefs. So it's more focused on those kind of extreme experiences and having a group to talk about those experiences rather than like a general support group or I know there's some groups that are more focused on depression or, you know, anxiety or those types of things. This is focused on being able to talk about those extreme experiences. It's as far as AA and NA, it's not a 12-step program, definitely not 12-step. As the Hearing Voices Network has a charter. We have a charter that lists out kind of what it means to be a Hearing Voices group. And some of the things are like belief that the experience is real. So that when people share their experiences, they're believed. And also not one way of thinking about the experience or explaining the experience. The group doesn't take a stance on, you know, the cause of people's experience and really leaves that open to personal interpretation. So in the same group, you may have people who talk about hearing voices or other experiences and explain why it happens because of trauma. They may explain it as spirits. They may explain it as possession. They may explain it as being in touch with other dimensions, spirituality. And any way that people explain is accepted and supported. And people share, you know, what does work for them and whatnot. But it's not about teaching one way of handling these things. It's really about supporting people where they're at and supporting people and how they view it.
Yeah, that's good. That sounds great. I was at a retreat and they had someone and they were, you know, explaining about the Hearing Voices Network and, you know, actually they were saying that people who hear voices are a very special people, unique, and it's not something that people should be putting down. My good friend Ken Braderman, who's now deceased, he used to talk all the time about how when he stopped writing for a newspaper, he drove a taxi, and he had two bears in his, not real bears, but two bears in his taxi, and they sort of like protected him from the other bad voices or whatever else. And I think helping people to make meaning of that is a really good thing because, well, I don't hear voices, but people have told me that you can't make them go away totally. So, you know, unless you just take mountains and mountains of drugs to...
Yeah, sometimes even taking a ton of drugs doesn't even work to make them go away. And sometimes they just, it's hard to predict. But from my experience, it's one of those things, if you really try to make them go away, then they usually don't. but if you're able to work with them and develop a better relationship with your voices, and a lot of what the Hearing Voices Network is about not trying to get rid of them, but trying to improve your relationship with the experience. And if that happens, sometimes they just go away naturally. But most of the time, people who hear voices, that's not what they want. They don't want the voices to go away, because a lot of times these are voices they've heard for, you know, sometimes since they were children. And
yes,
so they're like companions. They're companions, and friends. Even they don't want the voices to go away. They just want to improve their relationship with them.
Yeah, I had. I remember Mary and Anthes saying to me that. I heard a story that his wife had said about when they met, and he just thought that everybody heard voices.
Yeah.
That this was perfectly that he didn't understand that there were people that didn't, you know. And I mean, and we say sometimes really funnily, we say, you know, you pray, and for someone else, they say, well, God answers back. So what's, you know, what's the difference?
From that.
We're about 30 minutes into the show, and the show is going to end about 30 minutes sooner. It will end at 10:30. And I have lots of people on the air. I'm going to open up the lines in case someone wants to ask any questions. We haven't gotten to what you're doing now, but just in case people are burning to ask questions, they can press 1 or start 1 depending on if they're on a landline. They may not be, but we have lots of people that are out there. If anyone wants to ask a question or to relate to anything that that Orange has said, you can do that now. So I'm just opening the lines up for a little bit, just in case somebody has something to say about that. But the Hearing Voices Network, how big is that in the U.S.?
Well, it's definitely gotten a lot bigger since this latest rendition of it, and we founded the Hearing Voices Network USA in 2010. And since that time, we've been able to do training and education in probably most of the states of the country. Several new, gone from just a handful of groups to probably close to 100 groups in the U.S. that not all of them are listed on the website, but we know they're out there.
So there's a website, Hearing Voices Network.
Yeah, hearingvoicesusa.org.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we're active probably in most states. And in fact, there was just a big grant from the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care gave a big grant for the Hearing Voices movement, which allowed for training to happen in five different regions of the country, which is just last week they did a training in Michigan. They're going to be doing trainings in different parts of the country as a part of that. We're particularly active in Massachusetts. We've got several groups going in Massachusetts. There's also some groups happening in Oregon and actually all over the country. But and you can go on the website and there's a map. If you can click on Find a Group, and you can see if there's a group listed in your area.
Yeah, that's www.hearingvoicesusa.org.
Yep.
And I'll repeat that again during the show. So if you haven't gotten down, you should probably go and get a pencil and paper, because there might be other stuff that Orange talks about. And I know I remember seeing you at the ADA celebration for the anniversary of the passing of ADA.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, I've seen you at a few things. Yep.
So you're all over the place, and in fact, now that you've moved up, I think you became the director of the National Empowerment Center. Was it about last year this time?
I've been the director of the Technical Assistance Center since 2011, and then took over as acting executive director in April of this year.
Mm-hmm. From the former director, Dan Fisher, right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily understand about these technical centers. I know that the National Empowerment Center is the last of the early technical centers. Contact was one. They're no longer a technical center. VBSA is no longer a technical center.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly. What do you do?
Yeah. Well, okay. So, the center has one of five technical assistance centers. They call them consumer run or consumer supporter technical assistance centers, and we're one of five in the country. Originally, it started out with the self-help clearinghouse, mental
mm-hmm.
health self-help clearinghouse, and then we were the second one in about 90 to receive this. So we've had a technical assistance center for about 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And what the Technical Assistance Centers do, it's kind of a unique thing in the world to have a federal government support a national peer-run organization. So, you know, we use our lived experience to support specific states in the country to develop stronger peer networks in those states to help build peer-run organizations in those states and to help influence mental health policy in those states. And we also we have an area of focus through the grant with SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration. That's who funds us. We have a focus area, and for the next 5 years, our focus area is crisis, basically. They call it crisis response services. And as a part of that, we do a lot to support peer-run respites and also other alternative crisis supports, which is kind of brings me all the way back to when I was first in the hospital, and that's what I was hoping I would be able to do one day, is to try to really support on a big alternatives for people. So we spread the word about other ways of doing things besides hospitals, like
I know New Jersey Vermont. There are a few places that have it. What states do you have?
Well, it's kind of exciting because they changed it from from before. So for the next 5 years, we're assigned to 12 states. Now all states and territories in the U.S. are assigned to a technical assistance center, and we have 12 states that we're going to be working with, and they are the New England states, which are more in our backyard: Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont. And yes, I think I got all of those. And then we have some Midwestern states that we're working with: Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois. So those are our 12 states. And just actually finished a technical assistance application. So if you're in one of those states and you want to get some extra assistance in maybe building your peer organization, if you would need a training in organizational development or leadership, or we also do other trainings like emotional CPR, voice and dialogue. We do the hearing voices training. Or if you need some help building your strategic plan or sustainability plan, those are the types of things that we can do, and there's an application now that you can fill out. And you actually don't need to be one of those 12 states to apply, but you definitely get priority if you're from one of those.
If someone is in another state and they want to do a peer respite and they go assistance from you.
Yeah, especially if it's related.
But they have to stand in line behind the other people. Is that the way it works? So
well,
who's one of your states, if they have a pressing need, you have to take care of them first. Is that the way it works?
Yeah. I mean, people in the states that we're in would get priority, but you would also have a good chance of getting some technical assistance if you're applying for something in the area of crisis, because crisis is our area of focus nationally. So,
Well, that's what that's what the people that are the proponents of H.R. 2646, which is the Murphy bill, many of those people are saying, in fact, they got something out this now. They're saying they couldn't get their family member in the hospital. And, you know, I don't think that you need everybody to go to a hospital, but that's what they're saying is that they need more acute beds. And I just wondered, what was your experience in opening up these respites and whatever else? Do people really need to rush and go to acute care, or does it really vary?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, there's not enough alternatives available. I think if there were, and all the research that's been done on alternatives, like there's been really good research done on soteria houses. There's been some research done on other alternatives, some initial research on peer respites. Basically, all that research is reporting the same results, which is that people do a lot better in alternatives to hospitals. But the problem is we don't have enough. They're not funded. They're not obviously not backed by big pharmaceutical companies. People don't have enough alternatives to be able to go to, which means if people are really in distress and people don't know what to do and people are scared, the only option is hospital. So that's, you know, and so to make the argument that you need more beds, also make the argument that you need more alternatives because they actually work better. And so that's where we need to be focusing our attention is building more soteria houses, building more peer respites, building, doing more training like emotional CPR, intentional peer support, teaching the average person how to handle crises. Because we live in a culture now, if someone in the family or a friend is going through a really hard time and we don't know how to deal with it, we call professional. But these are for the most part, I think pretty much all situations can be handled by the community if the community is educated to handle these situations. And if people are willing to take the time to be with someone who's going through a hard experience, that's another factor is that people have gotten so busy in our culture that if they just, feel like they don't have the time to really spend with someone in an emotional crisis. So then, oftentimes that family member or community member gets shipped away from everything they know, their friends and family, and that can create a cycle of dependence on the system, and it also can be very difficult for someone to be taken away from everything they know.
There's a call from people to get this IMD exclusion. There's an exclusion that keeps institutions who have less than less than 16 beds from getting those federal funds. And how is the people with respite? How usually are they funded? I know it's probably a mixed bag, but I'm quite sure they wouldn't come under that same. Funded?
They're mostly funded through state government, so state departments of mental health, and there's about a little over 20 peer respites now across the country, and if you go to power, the number 2, the letter U.org, and you click on crisis alternatives, you can get a listing of all the peer respites that we know about in the country. But yeah, they're mostly funded by the state. There are a few that are starting to get some Medicaid funding, and then they might, if the Medicaid funded ones might fall under that, I'm not sure. But yeah, this whole IMD exclusion that's trying to make it easier to hospitalize people and have that covered. And again, I just don't think that's the right direction, because basically the Murphy bills, both bills, are leading us in a direction of more institutionalization, more locking people up out of fear, and we're already the country that institutionalizes the most people of, percentage wise than any other country, if you include prisons and nursing homes, hospitals. We love to institutionalize people here. Big reason is it's a big money, big business. So
yeah, because it usually takes about, I know from our state hospital, it's over $200,000, and for a peer respite, I've seen several presentations on them, and visited them, like in New Hampshire and New Jersey or whatever. It just seems as though it depends on the state, because some states can make it hard to have a peer respite if they require that they have all the insurance and stuff that a full blown medical facility has. But how does the cost for a peer respite, how does that stack up against someone being in a state hospital, and what's the stay usually like? I'm asking this, some of these questions I already know the answer to, and do they just help people while they're there, or is there services before or after the peer respite?
I'm on Facebook now, and I see that people are commenting on the show. This is great. So the average stay at a peer respite is anywhere from a week to 2 weeks, and it's designed to be a bit of a shorter stay. And what was the other part of the question?
Well, about, what's the cost versus being in a state hospital? Here it's over $200,000, because we have about 250 people in our equivalent of a state hospital, and they got over 1,000 employees, nurses, doctors.
The research that I've seen suggests it can be as much as one-third the cost of a hospital stay at a peer respite. So, it is more affordable, and also if you just think about the long-term results, if people are going to a peer respite, which is happening, and they're less likely to return to a hospital, and they're more likely to get a job and go back to work and get their life back, then you're looking at long-term savings of, millions of dollars potentially. Peer respites are fairly new, so, we don't have the long-term studies yet, but if you look at research on Soteria, which is a similar value system, similar alternative hospitalization. They had long-term outcomes that were extremely favorable, and people are going off of their Social Security and not depending on the system anymore, then you're looking at a long-term cost savings that, like I said, at millions of dollars of savings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I see, I saw a report, a news article, just I think it was Thursday or Friday, where a family member, a father, was suing insurance company because they wanted them to keep their son longer, that they let him out and was not, he said they, you know, they let him out before he was stable. And I think that, just want to say, what's the difference between, you said crisis, what's the difference between someone who is a candidate for a, I know you can't get it, there's all kinds of details, a candidate for a peer respite versus someone who may need hospitalization? Or are they really the same?
Well, there's a lot, there's some diversity among the peer respites in terms of how they interpret that question. But I try to advocate for peer respites to be able to handle any situation, because I feel like peers have the potential to be the best at being in a crisis situation. Just because you have lived experience doesn't mean you're going to do great work, and you know, I've seen that too. But so if you have people who are well trained, people who are willing to be with people who are going through very, very difficult states, extreme states, suicidal, whatnot, then you can have great results, even in the most extreme situations. And I'd like to see all the peer respites get to that point. I know a few are kind of already there. But, you know, my opinion is, you know, why should we look towards the hospital to situations when we know from our personal experiences that hospitals aren't really helping people to make meaning of these experiences, help people move through these experiences in a respectful way that honors a person's experience. Basically, a hospital is designed to try to get rid of that, the experience, as quickly as possible, which often is just heavy drugging, no really talking about what has led up to the experience, no working through the experience. And the peer respite can be a place where people can really talk about what they're going through and try to make meaning of what they're going through, because when we go through an altered state or extreme state, there's a reason why we go through these things. And and this is we see crisis as an opportunity. Crisis happens for a reason, and to explore and move through it and figure out what the reason is, and if you're able to do that, you're going to have a much better chance of, you know, full recovery and healing than if you're just, you know, treated in a way that's trying to get rid of the experience. And I think that's a reason why you see such a revolving door in the hospital.
Yeah, I agree with that. I've known people that have had 15, 16, and up hospitalizations. And like I said, the people that I have known that have hearing voices that have had a successful life, that's what they have told me. Like I said, I don't hear voice, but they've said the same thing that you said. They say that you can't, it's impossible to get rid of them. You know, you'd have to take so much chemicals that your teeth would fall out and that you wouldn't be able to do any meaningful things in life in order to do that. I don't know what's going to happen when the Murphy bill passes, because right now there seems to be a great groundswell of people to that are for that bill to pass. And
it's going to be really scary time, for sure.
I urge people, this is off topic, I urge people that are listening to the show who know that these very oppressive things like hospitalizations is that they call their congressperson and give them information about their experience and urge them not to support the Murphy bill. I don't know how this passed. How do you think it would affect the peer respites that are already in place? Well, not at all.
You know, if something does pass, and you know, I still have hope that we can stop it from passing. But if something does pass, hopefully we're at least able to get the worst stuff out of it before it passes. And it's going to be hard to say how a lot of this stuff is going to roll out, because passing a bill is one thing, and then then being able to fund it and implement it is another thing too. So, one of the.
Oh, that's right. That's right. They may not be able to fund it. I mean, they got a lot of. It's supposed to be revenue neutral.
Yeah, and it's not going to be revenue. Well, it's going to be a lot more expensive. So there's still, and maybe this will give people some hope too, is worst case scenario here is if one of these bills passes, there's still going to be a lot of advocacy work to do to try to, stop the funding for it, to, basically stop it from being implemented. There can be something around that, but right now we're focused on trying to still kill these bills, kill the bills.
Mm-hmm.
There's still hope.
Have you ever talked to any of these people that are really for the bill? Because I have talked to some of them. And I found that a lot of people they don't know what's in the bill, actually, and they really don't know. I've had people to tell me that SAMHSA has kept their son from getting care, and I've tried to remind them that the people who are proponents of this bill, they don't even want Medicaid expansion, they don't want affordable health care, and even if they are able to have assisted outpatient treatment for their loved one, if they get that, it's not really treatment. It's sort of like a judicial process, and that doesn't mean your county will have money to pay for it. I mean, actually, if they do away with the IMD exclusion, what they'll do is they'll have a battle between money for hospitals and money for the community. I really just feel as though that a lot of these people haven't really looked at the bill, and I don't even know if the people in the House and the Senate, if they really realize, I think they may realize, they just figure that, Republicans figure that they'll just take all the money and revert it back to the states and tell them to do that. But I think that that didn't work when you were in the hospital. It didn't work when I was in the hospital because then you'll have community centers and hospitals vying for state dollars. And I don't think that that will work out. And it will probably interfere with things like peer respite. And I wanted to ask you, why do you think that there's so many, are there more in the New England states than other places?
There is a lot going on in New England, and I'm not.
And do they have less hospital? They have less hospital. I know in Vermont, they don't have a state hospital anymore.
Yeah, I would say overall there's less hospitals per capita than other places. Although Boston area, there's quite a few hospitals. It's like central in that area, but actually eastern Massachusetts is quite a bit different from
mm-hmm.
But you're right, Vermont doesn't have a state hospital. Some of the early groups in our consumer survivor ex-patient movement started out in the east, northeast, you know, like Mental Patients Liberation Front. There's the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So you have kind of a history of grassroots activism up here, which has helped to this day, basically, kind of create a culture that's a bit different and a lot more alternatives, I think, available than other parts of the country.
Well, I want to say again, because there are quite a few people on the line.
Sure.
The lines are open. If you want to ask a question or you want to comment, you can do that now. So no one is speaking up, but I'm just saying there are a lot of people there.
There was a question I see on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Someone asked, how do you find out which technical assistance center? That's what the TAC stands for, technical assistance
mm-hmm.
center. Which technical assistance center serves your state? And specifically, I think she was asking about Colorado. So I have an answer for Colorado, which is the CAFE TA Center, which is located in Florida, actually. And they have a website if you... you want me to give the whole website for CAFE?
Yep. But I think okay. You put CAFE TA in and it comes up.
That's
a good. Mhm.
Yeah, you go. It's just CAFETACenter.net. So they serve Colorado. If people have questions about what TA Center serves them, feel free to call in or Facebook, or you can contact me through the National Empowerment Center, and I can let you know who your TA center is.
And that's Power to You, POWER, the number 2, U.org. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. And I'm just Oryx, ORYX, Power to You.org.
Mhm. Mhm. I kind of lost my place now because we were talking about the technical centers and the peer respites and the effect that might occur if you have if there is an IMD exclusion, because the hospitals have a higher degree of staffing that they have to have than a peer respite, and it's very expensive. As I said, the one of the features of the Murphy bill is that it is the Senate and the House side is asking for the IMD exclusion to be lifted, and those big hospital stays do take a lot of time and a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, ultimately, a lot of people who are behind the Murphy bills would like to see a lot of what we do in the consumer survivor movement go away. One thing that I didn't mention before is that part of our role is also to organize the National Alternatives Conference. We rotate with the two other consumer-run TA centers to organize the biggest national peer-run conference in the country. As a result of if these bills get passed, or one of these bills gets passed, that it's an attack on our movement. And it's going to mean that we're more likely not to be funded in the future, not to even have a grant in the future. And
because it is supposed to be revenue neutral, and I'm more concerned about some of the rights, but you're correct. Everything that's in the bill is oriented toward medical. They even say what degrees the person has to have. I mean, a lot of people haven't heard that, but they are having a either assistant secretary or deputy secretary, I can't remember which one it is, of HHS, politicizing HHS, and everything in it says it has to be revenue neutral. There's incentives for people to have assisted outpatient treatment. And then they talk really badly about the peer specialists. They could have just taken that stuff out. But I haven't found any part of the bill that was good. And that's why I say that it has to be killed, because there's really no good part of it.
The most disturbing parts of the bill are the parts that are taking away our human rights. And, just singling us creating fear in people and making the association between mental health and violence, which is not a causal relationship at all, but making, people are afraid and they want to see all these shootings stop, which we all want to see these shootings stop, but they're connecting it to mental health. And
there's no connection.
But that's how they're operating. People are believing it because the more you say something, the more it's believed, and then you cannot focus on, the real problems in the culture, which are, one major one is that we have, assault rifles readily available. Another, probably even more important, is that we have created a society where people more and more are feeling so alienated and isolated and distressed that they feel the need to, take it out in such ways. So instead of building community, instead of building a society that we all want to live in, instead of, getting guns off the streets, we're enacting these policies that are not going to fix the problem. They are not. The problem of violence is not going to go away when these bills are passed.
Well, let's hope that people get off their rear ends and for the next couple of days, because the bill is being marked up, and I'm hoping that people will.
Yeah.
That people will go to the. Will call their congresspersons and the congresspersons in their state as well to say this is something that they don't want, and to talk about how it's adversely affected them in the past. And if people are on our show, at least if you go to the directory, you'll see that we've had several times in which we've had a reading of the bill. Reading means that we've actually read it, so you can download it to an MP3 player and listen to it and not just count on somebody else's words about what's in the bill. I've talked to some people, and unfortunately, they talk about things that are in the bill that are not there. There's no additional monies that are there. You can go to realmhchange.org, R-E-A-L, mhchange.org, and you can find a whole lot of information there, talking points and whatever else. And there's a lot of misinformation about this bill. This bill does not add any new money. If you live, especially if you live in a small town or a small county that's already stressed with services, there's no extra money for you. In fact, this is a physically conservative bill that calls for it being revenue neutral. So many of the things that are in there I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yvonne and Orch, this is Sarah Knutson, and this is like an awesome show, and I'm so grateful that Orch is here and that you guys are talking about the bill right now. And one of the things that came up in a conversation today with someone else is that it's one thing to say that we don't like the Murphy bill, but we were also wondering and we're thinking it would be awesome for us as a movement to actually propose a bill that we do want. And so, because then we can begin talking about, like 30 years ago, we came up with the Declaration of Principles that said, we don't like the psychiatric system. It sucks. It has to go. But it would be lovely for us to, at this point, come up with a new Declaration of Principles that says, in the last 30 years, we've learned some things, and these things are here to stay, and they have to be a part of any mental health strategy that is worth its salt, and any mental health strategy that is worth its salt has to include the following principles, and that these things have to be part of a bill, and they have to be part of legislation. And oh, by the way, this is the legislation that we are proposing. These are the things that you need to fund. There needs to be a peer support center in every community. There needs to be a respite center in every community. There needs to be hearing voices in every community. There needs to be ECPR in every community. There needs to be intentional peer support in every community. There needs to be an Icarus group in every community. There should be no community in the United States where people don't have access to these things. Every single hospital in the United States ought to have access to these things. You ought not be able to call yourself a mental health center and receive federal funding unless you are providing access to these things. This is what real choices mean to people. People ought to have these choices. It's not enough to say that you are providing you are not providing culturally competent support to the people that you say you are providing support to unless you actually provide peer support from real people who have actually been through things. We ought to have a declaration of principles, and we need our national leaders, our national organizations, to like lead the way to say, the people who actually know how to who have the knowledge to write legislation, and who are actually doing this stuff to to take the lead and say these are the things, you know, to actually write draft legislation that says these are the things that our community stands for. This is what needs to come on. You hit it on the head, girl.
I completely agree. We need the National Coalition has come up with a list of recommendations for a bill, and we need to find a champ. We need to have a champion. We need a representative or a senator.
Barbara is no longer there.
I love that you've come up with that. What I'd like to have. I mean, don't fucking wait for them to be your champion. Get it to every peer support center in the country. I mean, we want to see
what
you're doing.
Every
peer support center in the country can be going to their legislators and saying, why the fuck aren't you championing our bill?
People think that they're forbidden from educating their legislators. There's a difference between lobbying and educating, and they're not. And we may have to go back to our roots. Yvonne,
the vast majority of people in peer centers don't work for those peer centers. So the peers in the peer centers, so like most of us who are in the peer centers, we're not paid. So we get to lobby all we want. So you don't have to depend on peer employees. You're preaching to the choir,
and you know the audience of this show is people that are that way. It's just that we have to have a vehicle, and that means a place that we sit down, and
we are the vehicle. I haven't heard of this legislation, and I'm pretty damn active. So why isn't this stuff out there, and why aren't there emails going out from all of the technical assistance centers that are federally paid? I mean, Oryx, when are we going to see this? And I love you. I mean, I think you're doing incredible work. I love what you're doing, but can you please get us this legislation, and can you please start a national campaign so that we can all start pushing this stuff that otherwise we don't have anything to tell our people? When they say, well, you don't have a solution, we just sit there and go, you're right, we don't, but we do.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's
so
the direction we need
to
go. I mean, I think
I don't work
for the coalition, so I can recommend that that's what the coalition does, but I don't work for the coalition.
I think what Sarah is asking, and I'm going to ask that question.
And I agree with you, Sarah. So
let me ask you this question. This will clear this up. And I've heard this from many people on social media. And what people are asking is this question. Why isn't National Empowerment Center, why isn't STAR Center, why isn't PeerLinks, why aren't they? That's what she's asking is, and Sarah, please give him a chance to answer. They want to know, why aren't they involved in writing legislation or whatever? And I think the answer is that they can't use the money that they have as the same reason for the PAMI. But I want... These are the people that, if the Murphy bill comes to pass, these are the organizations who will lose their funding. So the question is, why aren't they introducing legislation? And let him have a chance to answer, okay?
Sure. Well, we're funded through SAMHSA, and there's specific requirements within the grant. One of which is that we can't do this type of... We can do education around policy and whatnot, but as far as endorsing a specific bill, that is definitely something we can't do.
So it's people like me and Sarah and others that have to do that. And you said, and the National Coalition. Who's head of the National Coalition now?
That's why the coalition was formed, to have an organization that could do this type of work. Unfortunately, it's not very well funded at all. There's been some organizational issues, which hopefully are getting back on track now. I don't think people know that Aidan Campbell McCollum was just brought on.
Wonderful.
Yes, to the
wonderful
coalition. And so I will talk.
No,
with,
I didn't know I, that. I didn't know that. When did that happen? Where
it's
is
lovely.
Lovely.
It's lovely.
Yeah. So Aidan is the new public policy director for the coalition.
Awesome.
And I agree with you, Sarah. We need to have our own legislation. We need to stop. We can do the fighting of bad legislation. That's fine, but it's going to be a whole lot more powerful to advocate for something we want.
Well, and it develops a vocabulary. It actually supports us to develop the vocabulary to begin to describe what it is that we do in a way that real people can understand that we are a real alternative. If we just are fighting what we want, people don't understand what we do and what it is that we do that is so powerful. And we do something that's tremendously powerful. It's life-changing. It's revolutionary. And if we don't begin to try to say, to try to propose it as legislation and try to describe it and put it into words, then our people don't have the vocabulary to actually say what's happening in our lives and describe it to our families and friends, what it is that's making the difference in our lives that we know is making a difference.
Yeah, one thing that we could really use is a congressman or a senator, I don't think it matters, who is a champion who will help us to write the specifics of the bill, because if you've ever read these bills, it's like a different language. It's like, you know, ridiculously.
Yeah, it's like a Congress speak. Sort of like.
I do think that we. I mean, it's not just you guys have your hands tied, and I can get that. But there's all these other organizations like Mental Health America and the Baselin Center and all these other, like Baselin Center, those are lawyers. I mean, they're supposed to be capable of doing this kind of stuff. They say they're representing us. They say that they stand for the issues that we stand for. So why aren't they championing this stuff for us? They are getting money.
Sarah, all these people, you have to calm down and understand this. All of these people I'm going to say it. All of these people have their own interests that are involved.
That's
and
my point.
Sarah, look at them. They all have their own interests, and if you look at the changes that's in the bill, we only got a few more minutes.
Make
sure other people have. Everyone has their own interests, and even different peer groups have their own interests. And unless you call people out, and you say that is why the grassroots individuals have to speak up. I mean, there are other people, and they have thousands of people out there, and they, to their
that
interest.
Is my point. That is my point, is that they say they represent
us. We have to have transparency, and we don't have transparency even within our own group, because people do not tell the truth, and that's part of the problem, that people do not tell the truth. They are, they don't tell the truth. But I want to get on more with, we have about 10 or 15, about 8 more minutes. Does anyone else on the line want to come in and make a comment or question? Anyone else need to come in right now? Someone is trying to text me. Okay. Someone is saying that I should not be telling you to calm down. Okay, all right. I shouldn't have told you to calm down.
We're all very passionate about this. So, you know, Sarah's lighting a fire.
We're all passionate about it, but we have to think.
And we're going to make this happen.
The thing about it is part of the problem that we've had that we've got so many people that claim that they want to speak for people, but they're not, because they don't have it. They don't have the same experience. They don't have the experiences that people have, and
they haven't talked to us. They represent us. They represent us, and they've never met us. They're getting a boat.
Not only they've never met us, what happens is they don't understand us, because if for example the Murphy Bill. It's been out for 2 years now. You should know what it's about. And so if this is all new to you, you really don't understand that. And that's part of the problem, that people don't understand it. Also, they don't understand how Congress works. And so that hasn't gotten to a lot of people as well. And also, there's a lot of division ourselves, because people have sold out, have sold us down the river. And usually the people who do not sell us out, they do not get to the positions to represent us. They are not in that position to do that.
You're absolutely right. That would be Lauren Tenney's point, is they compromise away our rights. They have never met us. They have never talked to us. They do not recognize the implications of it's for them. It's a job. For us, it's our lives. They go home at night.
It will be someone's life when their rights are taken away from them. If you look at I want to turn it back to Orange, but if you look at the things that are in the Murphy Bill, for example, it really will make it so that anyone who has a label of any kind, that they could be put into assisted outpatient treatment if those incentives are there, because a lot of states will want to get those, even states that now have assisted outpatient treatment. We had open-ended outpatient treatment in the District of Columbia. Many people, I'm 63 years old, they don't remember this, but people were on AOT for their entire life. And when they took a particular treatment, and treatments can be not just chemicals, it could be going to a day treatment program or whatever, so that you might not be able to work a job. It could be that you're having severe side effects, and the doctor cannot even change the medication unless he gets a court order to change it. So there are a lot of things that there. The PAMIs are there because there were lots of abuses that occurred in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and there's still abuses that happen now. A lot of the abuses are neglect, not necessarily abuse. When I hear people say that they want to get their loved ones into the hospital, I understand that they're dealing with a crisis at the time. They don't have what ORIX is trying to spread around the country. They don't have that available. But what has happened is that the longer a person is locked up into an institution, there's more possibility of abuse. We have an expose now that's coming out of what's happening in Florida. And the jail diversion program also, it helps people who would ordinarily go to prison, but also it means that a lot of our very vulnerable people in the hospital have to deal with people that are very dangerous. And I just hope that people that are listening to this show, that they will, in the next couple of days, call their congressmen and the people on the Energy and Commerce Committee and on the Senate side and express their views on this thing, and go to realmhchange.org. We have about 6 more minutes, and I wanted to get into with you, Oryx, are there any new initiatives or things that the Empowerment Center is doing now?
Honestly, we're spending a lot of our time right now trying to figure out how to best work with 12 states, because it's a big change from the past when we work with 3 states. So it's going to be definitely a lot different. And they didn't increase our budget to it. They didn't increase our staff to do it. So, that's going to be a lot of work. And, but as always, we'd be on the lookout for, we want to do more webinars this year.
Mm-hmm.
At first, I wasn't all that jazzed about a webinar, but when it turns out that, 500 people usually attend these things. It is a good way to get some information out, to have somewhat of a dialogue. It's hard on a webinar, but they take questions and whatnot. And it's also good because the webinar is archived, and so you don't have to actually attend to get the information, whether it's information about how to start a peer respite or how to do evaluation or emotional CPR, whatever the webinar is about, you can watch it anytime you want. And also we're going to be, as a part of what we're doing, we're going to be looking more and more into virtual support, texting and apps, and I know that Sarah has a virtual peer respite. Sarah, are you still on?
Yeah, yes, I am.
Do you want to say how people can get involved with the virtual peer respite?
Sure. I mean, right now we're sort of just forming, so we're more of a drop-in center than a respite. But
okay.
It's really simple. We have something going every evening, and you can join two ways. You can call toll free, 855-661-1243, or you can join us by the internet and listen. And also if you have capacity to like a headset, then you can talk also. And to do that, you just dial Uber Conference. UBER conference, UBERCONFERENCE .com/ purely human, PERLYHUMAN. So that's how you join.
Awesome. And yeah, this
repeat that again.
Uber conference, UBERCONFERENCE /, purely human, PERLYHUMAN. Or you call me at home, 802-279-3876, and I'll figure out how to connect you. I'll get you the information.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that can't get places, or more and more people are online doing Facebook and doing all sorts of things. So the more that we can do to support people virtually is going to be powerful too. So we want to support things like what Sarah's doing. So
Well, let me ask you this question, because I'm getting the signal that I may have to cut off, and our show is normally 2 hours, but for some cell phone problems, I'm having to have to cut.
My kids.
Question is, this is a question. Do you have to be a state-sanctioned FAMHSA-funded peer organization to get TA? And I know that's no.
Well, it depends on what the TA is for. But so if you're not one of our states, you're applying for like some help with organizational development, we'll probably refer you to the TA center that is your TA center. Basically,
but you don't have to be already receiving SAMHSA money. Like some people say, they have to be a consumer network.
Yeah, the short answer is anybody can apply and get some help, potentially, yes.
And I want to ask a question. Sarah, can you post the new alert to your groups?
Absolutely.
And I'll send it to you later, okay? Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay?
Thank you.
All right.
That's wonderful.
And,
thank you.
I want to say thank you very much. I know the 15th, November 15th, we're going to have Emily, I might be pronouncing her name, Troy Young. She's a Taiwanese American person who spoke at Alternatives. She will be on the show. And if you have any ideas about the show, please text me on Twitter at YZSmith@yahoo.com. Or at Yvonne Z. Smith on Facebook, and all of my information. Even if you're not my Facebook friend, I have things so open that you can get up there and that you can see that. And I wish you to have a very good week, and please educate your Congress and your senators. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
All right, thanks for having me. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Oryx. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Yvonne. Thank you. Bye-bye now. Mm-hmm.